IVM.
Hello, simplified listeners. This is Chuck here, one third of your hosting triumvirate. So as you might have imagined, we do not have an episode this week, but aha, we are not going to rebroadcast an episode like we usually do. We are going to do something a little more creative this time. But let me take a step back. Travel, it's what opens up our minds to the world and empties our bank balance, usually. I travel myself a lot, usually from Goregaon where I stay to the IVM studio in Khar. Clearly, I did not make that trip this time, which is why you are hearing this episode. But one such time when we did travel, we had Utsav Mamoria on our podcast when he was talking about budget travel, slow travel, how to travel, and in another episode, market research. But let's focus on the travel part of things. Utsav came onto a show and got so enamored of talking in front of a mic that he ended up having his own show on the IVM network. And it's called Postcards from Nowhere. And I'm pretty sure you've heard of this because Postcards from Nowhere has quickly become one of the most popular shows on the network. And if you haven't heard it, you really should. It's an absolutely fun podcast on slow travel and how to, you know, get the best out of every place that you visit, really. And it might give you a few new travel tips. And each episode is pretty short, which is a complaint of mine. I wish they were a little longer. What's fascinating is that a lot of the concepts that Utsav spoke to us about have been polished and they have been turned into full episodes on his podcast. So we'd actually like to do a sort of like a crossover episode where we play bits from the initial interview and which we had, and then that fully fleshed out story, which is on his show, Postcards from Nowhere. And we'll obviously play some bits from his episodes on Postcards from Nowhere on this show. And if you like it out, you should check it out. It's a really, really good show. Congratulations, Utsav, for starting your podcast and for making it to the iTunes top, whatever, whatever. And to everybody else, we hope you enjoy this special crossover episode. And yeah, happy travels, I suppose. And we will see you next week with, hopefully, an actual simplified episode.
In Armenia, I lived with the last remaining Aryan priests of the country. And in the backdrop of the violent nationalism my own country is going through, it forced me to ask the most fundamental question. Who am I and what is my identity? I spent almost 3 weeks in Armenia. And
again,
by the way,
for
the first time in my life, I went into a museum abroad and saw a pamphlet in Hindi. I was shocked.
What? Get out of here. Why?
In Yerevan, that was the National Museum. Fantastic museum. If you ever go to Yerevan, please take half a day to see that museum. There is so much about the world we don't know. And there was a pamphlet in Hindi. And I had to ask the curator sitting there that how do you even have a pamphlet in Hindi? So apparently, Indians are the sixth most visited tourist country, as in, tourists from India go to Armenia. And
really?
I was like, I have no freaking idea. I don't even know one person who has gone there. I know a lot of people who travel. And it was really nice to see an Indian language, out there.
There's something similar to this. So I grew up in Bahrain. It's a small country next to Qatar in the Middle East. And there are so many of us Malayalis over there that the official forms come in three languages. In order, there's Arabic, then there's English, and then there's Malayalam. On their official state forms. But so I get...
Yeah. And very interestingly, I also want to share a small piece of history which specific to Bombay and Yerevan. What connects Bombay and Yerevan is that if you go to South Bombay, there is a David Sassoon Library.
Yeah.
Right? And David Sassoon is actually Armenian.
Okay.
And when I told that to my walking tour guide, he was completely blown away because he had no idea that someone even knows David Sassoon back in India.
Wow.
So, yeah.
He was like the richest man in the world or
probably,
something.
Probably, I don't
time.
Know. Yeah. So, yeah. I got to know much more about David Sassoon much later. So,
unfortunately, most people most troublemakers in Bombay know David Sassoon Library because of London Blockley, which is above it.
Yeah.
Never mind.
In June 2018, in a much less ambitious journey, I slipped into a new existence as a traveler. I took a 3-month sabbatical to travel the less explored parts of the world, looking to experience emotions which often desert us in our everyday lives. En route to Bosnia and Herzegovina, in a heartwarming encounter with a Pakistani, I grappled with the idea of home, the adopted lands we physically live in, and the motherlands we mentally inhabit. On a back-breaking hike to Lukomir, the remotest village in Bosnia and Herzegovina, I dwelled on the phenomenon of aging, a reality which we hate to accept, but is more of a mental block than an actual problem. In a secret bunker in the heart of former Yugoslavia, I understood the true nature of intrinsic fear, both of the past and the future, and how it destroys our potential to live a full life. In Nagorno-Karabakh, a country that exists on the map but the world doesn't recognize, in an active minefield, I understood the true nature of forgiveness from people who had lost everything. I want to talk about one specific story which probably has been my most intense experience of traveling in 10 years. Is I was in this region, which is a disputed region between Armenia and Azerbaijan. It's called Nagorno-Karabakh or Artsakh. Now, by the way, because I went to that place, I can never enter Azerbaijan again or ever because I have a visa for Nagorno-Karabakh on my passport.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
So
I'm barred from entering Azerbaijan now for life.
Oh.
So, and I was just going to that region because I just found it a little offbeat and interesting enough. I was trying to book an accommodation, right? And every single booking website in my life I have known showed me zero availability. When I had to put that place on maps, I could not find it. Because since it's not officially recognized, it is actually called by the name what the Azerbaijan side calls it, right? So somehow managed to find something on Airbnb, got and booked it. And one day I was just walking and I was reading my guidebook. I read something about an organization called the Halo Trust. So the Halo Trust works worldwide towards demining conflict zones. And I'd seen their work about 10 years ago in Cambodia when I was traveling. I just thought I want to make a small donation. Because I think it's a really, really difficult job to do. And when I entered their office, they were so surprised to find a tourist walk in because this has never happened with them. And they sat down with me and had a conversation. How do you even know about us? And when I gave them the entire background, they said, if you are free tomorrow, we will take you to an active landmine site.
Whoa.
They drove me 2 hours to an active landmine site. The region is a hilly region. They drove me and I was going through areas which were demined. I could see rocket fragments lying next to me.
Ooh.
And they took me to the top of a hill, which is basically a monastery, right? And the entire hill was landmined.
Whoa.
Right? And that's where I got the idea of getting the name of my book. It's called Monastery in a Minefield.
How?
Right? And they actually took me down to the hill. And imagine, it's a good 60-degree incline, right? Imagine the entire hill mined. So there are workers who dig every square centimeter of their hill to look for landmines.
Wow.
And they took me and showed me the entire process. And what's the interesting part of this, most of these deminers had actually lost their own family members in the conflict.
Oh.
Right? And they knew that some of these landmines have been laid by their own people.
Yeah.
Because the hill has changed hands over wars. Yeah. Because of a strategic point.
Yeah.
And I was talking to one of them and I was trying to understand that how do you deal with something which has taken the life of someone who's your own? And it was a very, very simple thing. They said, you have to learn to forgive and move on. Because that hate will eat you up from inside.
Mm.
It's a very, very simple thing. It's a very profound thing when you think of it. You know, whatever will be happening around us, we get so caught in our petty battles of, I don't like this person, I have ego issues with this colleague is shit. But if you look at it, people who have seen real loss are the people who can really teach us about how to live.
Yeah.
And that experience was not
Rise above pettiness and see the...
And, yes, it's a well-paying job, but it's an extremely dangerous job.
Mm.
But 2 years ago, they unfortunately had an accident and they lost a person.
Wow, okay.
Right? So it's not...
I cannot imagine how anyone does this safely. I mean, at the end of the day, you put your shovel to the mine, it's going to explode.
It's not that simple. Yeah. There are lots of procedures. Yeah. Because landmine gets triggered by weight. It gets triggered by a certain force. There are tank mines and there are person mines. And so not everything is a tripwire which we see in Hollywood films.
I think that's another great travel advice by itself. Don't experience basis Hollywood. What pop culture, especially Hollywood, tells you.
And you know, I was talking to that... the program manager for Halo Trust, and we were just talking. I remembered a very famous African proverb. It says that when elephants fight, it is the grass that suffers. If you go and talk to people of that region, they have forever lived in the this whole space of there could be a conflict anytime.
Yeah,
right. How do you live with the amount of stress? And you know, and if you feel that you don't need to go to Armenia, I genuinely feel go to Kashmir. There are a lot of people who are living under that stress every single day.
Yeah.
Because they're sandwiched between two forces.
Yeah.
Right? But we don't think of these things, right? I mean, we are too comfortable in our lives.
This whole thing of slow travel is like very interesting, actually, and it's something I've been seeing. I think so the two are like there are two parts to it. Like I think a lot of people, when they feel that they are spending a lot of money traveling to a particular location, it's so close by. Let's do that also.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
I think that temptation is always going to be there, and I don't think it's going to go away. So a little bit.
So
of context.
I'm just curious to know what the genesis of that is, if any, because I think it's fairly modern, right? So this desire to see as many sites as possible and tick them off. So I saw the Leaning Tower of Pisa. I saw Eiffel Tower.
Sure,
So you couldn't get the same kind of wow if you went and said that I really looked at Leaning Tower from inside out or right, left, everything. And I know everything there is to know about Leaning Tower. But you did see Eiffel Tower will be like that. Yeah. So I
just a very small thing on that. If you're really into history or architecture, let's say, and you really admire a building, you've been wanting to see this building forever.
Yeah.
If you really want to etch it in your memory, sit down in front of the building. You can take 1,000 pictures. No matter how bad you are at sketching, sketch it.
Sketch it.
The amount of detailing you will see.
You will notice.
You will notice.
Brilliant. That's a brilliant tip. I'm going to do this always. I've always wanted to do this. So we spent some time in Vienna and Prague. And there were these lovely castles and everything. And I was like, I should sketch. And I bought a pad. I took a pen. But I never seemed to have the time. I never did that.
Because you probably had to get somewhere.
Yeah.
That's the problem,
that castle
right?
is missing.
What happens is when you have 2 or 3 days in a city, you are trying to pack in as much as possible.
Yeah.
Because realistically, you know, you're not going to come back.
Yeah.
Unless it's a city you absolutely fell in love with.
Yeah.
You're not going to come back to that city.
Absolutely.
Right? So the thing is that... If you think of your vacations, the ones which you took very, very quickly, you would have very, very faint memories of it. Right? And that's fundamentally becoming the problem, that we have all the resources to travel as much as we want, but we don't have the senses to retain it anymore. Right?
I'll just take your sketching tip and I'll try to offer a compromise for people who don't have the time to sit and do that. So I carry my SLR with me everywhere I go. Right? And after one particular vacation, I forgot which it was, I just had a horrible time going through photos because my logic was I'll edit it later. We'll fix it in post, as they say. So what I would do is I would take 300 photos of the same thing and then it'd be a massive nightmare to fix it later. So then next trip I went, I said, okay, this time I'm going to make life for myself easier. And what I'm going to do is I'm actually going to take only like 2 photos every day. That will force you to think about what you're going to take.
Exactly.
And when you do that, you end up noticing a lot of things that you spoke about when you're sketching. It won't give you the full experience
Idea is the same.
But the idea is largely the same. And then you say, oh wow, I never noticed
a lot
that.
Of thought into
thought
that
behind
thing.
It. Yeah. So there's more quality into what you're doing. Yeah. But if I had the time, obviously sketching and
the other thing, of course, is if you want to write about it. If that's a skill you enjoy. Like I prefer writing because my sketching skills are shit. And I like writing. So that's what I do for it. The other thing also is that once you spend time thinking what you want to frame in a photograph, like our desire generally is that you capture everything. You literally want to go back and recreate what you saw. That's not ever going to happen.
Yeah.
And as you rightly said, you know, once you say that, okay, about this particular thing, is it the water? Is it the mountain? Is it the lighthouse?
Yeah.
you focus on that.
Yeah.
Because once you look at, go back and look at that picture, it will trigger massive something. Set of memories,
yeah.
which will really leave you on a very happy space.
Yeah. And how many of these photos do you go back and see in any
exactly,
case?
Exactly.
Right? They reside on your phone, on your Instagram feed, whatever.
Yeah. Like I have an Instagram feed. If you go and look at my follow list, it's complete shit. I have probably 250 followers on my Instagram.
It's quality.
I have doubts about that as well. But yeah, I've realized that, that you know, you can post 1,000 pictures, but ultimately what you retain from that picture is what really matters. Yeah. In June 2015, I moved to Shanghai, excited to be living in an alien country. In a bid to further push my new experiences, I started hosting people on Couchsurfing. What is Couchsurfing, you may ask? It is a simple idea. If you have some free space at home and would like to meet travelers passing through the city, you sign up. You can list your place on the website and travelers can request to stay. So what makes it different from Airbnb? Well, there is no money involved. A host cannot charge the guest. The entire premise is based on the idea of kindness. So I'll give you my experience of couchsurfing. I had never couchsurfed till 2014.
Okay.
And 2014, I moved to China for a 6-month stint at work. And I was living by myself, and it was a completely new country. I probably knew one person at best. So I thought that, you know, why not host people on couchsurfing? Shanghai, sure. I was in Shanghai, it's an expensive city. So there are more than enough people wanting to stay for free. And I hosted close to, I think, 30 people over 6 months.
Wow.
Right? And that experience was so enriching for the simple reason that we have stopped thinking about that life can mean so many different things to people that what we think of. There are so many ways to live life. Mm-hmm. And I met the most interesting people from that space. I met a musician who has been able to make more money than he was making at Wall Street by living in some obscure corner of the US. I met a student of anthropology who had never been outside the United States.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And he felt that he was living a very fake life because you cannot be an anthropologist studying only your own country. I mean, it's cultural anthropology. It's his take on it. I met people who travel with 2 pairs of clothes for a year.
Wow.
And I thought I was being minimalistic till I saw them. So what happens in couchsurfing essentially is, to those who may not be aware of it, is that you don't pay for stay. You write a request. You create a profile, write a request, and the host has a choice to accept it. And they will communicate upfront that this is the living condition, this is the living space, these are the rules, house rules and everything. Now, what happens is, and I will speak from the perspective of being a man, because my concerns about safety are much, much lesser than a woman has to think about.
Yeah.
So, because of the fact that I was able to host so many people, they would leave references. Right. So next time, if I have to send a request to someone, the fact that they will see so many positive experiences of people, they would look at me in a positive light.
Sure.
And there's no other way to judge. Right. So if, and that's completely free. So while I have hosted a lot, I have not stayed with someone yet. But one good way for you to subsidize your travel is that if you have your space, or for example, if it's just one bed you have free and you're willing to talk to people who are from different parts of the world, create a profile on couchsurfing. Filter people. Don't let everyone in. Don't be stupid. Mm-hmm. Don't let everyone in. Look at their profiles. Look at, are they verified?
Sure.
Have they been through a lot of couchsurfing experiences and they've come out positive? What happens is that helps you build a profile.
Sure.
So the next time you travel and send out a request, you're far more likely to get accepted.
Mm-hmm.
The second thing which you will learn is the way a local can show you a place, nobody can.
Nobody can.
And I think that's, I don't think that's even up for debate.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And I, in fact, had a Chinese student come and stay with me. She was a student of ancient Chinese art. And she was in town for some work.
Mm.
And she took me to places in Shanghai I had not even heard of. And I was living there for 6 months.
Mm.
Right? So that became a very great experience for me. So look at couchsurfing. It's free.
Sure.
It's a great way to understand people and cultures. And it's a great way to look at how people live their lives.
Sure. How does couchsurfing hold up with visas, though? Because you're not technically paying, right?
No. So what you do is basically you get your visa the regular way. Right?
And then
to contact people in advance.
Yeah.
Because we are not white, we can't just land up in a country's airport without a visa. So it works very well for white people. But it works for us as well if you are being willing to be a little smart about it. The only thing I would recommend is that if you are fussy about staying, please don't take up couchsurfing.
Hmm.
Right? Because it's someone is doing you a favor, so you can't go with the expectation of
getting
I will get X
service or
and get Y.
Yeah.
But trust me, you will get more than you can ever think of.
Sure. Wow.
That's a great
I think
trip.
That's all that we could ask for from stay.
Yeah.
that's just that section.